Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 132 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight, and with me are my usual co-hosts. First is David Vanderhoof from the What Just Flew By blog. Hi, David.
Hi, Max. Hi, guys. Hello, our listeners out there.
Also with us, of course, is Rob Mark from the Jetwine blog. What's the problem, Rob?
The Bears lost.
Oh, what a shock.
What do you mean, what a shock? I mean, I thought they were going to kick the Packers' butts. In fact, I even tweeted that. Now I'm going to have to go back and look at all the things people are tweeting me. Anyway, well, good evening, everybody.
Also here is Dan Webb from the Things in the Sky blog. Hi, Dan.
Hey, everyone, and good evening. And Rob, now you know how I felt last week.
Yes, I guess you're right.
Our guest this episode is Peter Sanders. He's a staff reporter in the Los Angeles Bureau of the Wall Street Journal. He covers the commercial aerospace industry. Welcome to the show, Peter.
Thank you, Max. And thank you, all of you guys, for hosting on this venerable podcast. I'm excited to be here.
Oh, we're really glad to have you. Now, you write a lot of articles about aviation for the Journal, but you're not just some writer who thinks he knows about aviation. I understand you earned your private pilot license at age 17, and you have a lot of time in smaller Cessnas and Pipers, but you've also flown a de Havilland Beaver, a Cessna Caravan, and a Cessna Citation Mustang.
It's been a lot of fun. I don't owe Cessna anything. They don't own me. I don't know them, but I just seem to have found myself in their airplanes a lot. So lest you think that I am all Cessna all the time, it's not true. But I have spent a lot of time with Cessna, and you know, luckily my current job allows me to spend a lot more time with all the other OEMs and various airplane makers, and I've been afforded a lot of time up front and all sorts of different airplanes, which has been great.
That is great. Sounds kind of like a dream job for an aviation enthusiast.
Oh, absolutely. I think it is a dream job for an aviation enthusiast. The only negative is that occasionally the aviation people end up yelling at you if they don't like what you write. So the downside is you get to take a lot of heat from folks, but the upside is much better than the downside.
That's great. Okay, coming up, we've got the week's aviation news. We have the Australia Desk Report coming from Steve and Grant from the Plane Crazy Down Under podcast. And we have Peter Johnson's Across the Pond segment for a little bit of European flavor. But first, let's start out with the week's aviation news. First story comes from the Wall Street Journal. Actually, this is a story that our guest Peter Sanders wrote, or maybe co-wrote. This is Boeing sees long-delayed 787 deliveries starting in third quarter. Scott Fancher, who's the general manager of the 787 program, says, "The revised timeline for first delivery accommodates the work we believe remains to be done to complete testing and certification of the 787. Of course, All Nippon Airways, ANA, is the first customer, the launch customer, and they're eagerly awaiting their first airplane. So hopefully this will be the last delay or the last significant delay. But I don't know, how confident are you guys that ANA is going to receive their first plane in the third quarter?
Shall I be the first one to say not or not very?
So, Rob, you're pessimistic, huh?
I think almost anybody would be at this point. What did they say? I think this is the Peter, you might know this better than I. Yeah. Seventh delay or eighth delay?
This depends on how you count it, obviously, but this is sort of the seventh official delay for those keeping score at home.
Yeah, not good.
Yeah, I mean, from my perspective, I think, Boeing has obviously gotten themselves into quite a fix on all sorts of aspects with the 787, and I think one of the biggest ones that they continually sort of pay the price for is setting these deadlines, and then they miss them. And obviously their customers demand deadlines. I'm sure they have internal deadlines. Everyone wants to know when they're getting their airplanes. But Boeing's, one of their big mistakes they've made on this program is setting these targets that in the beginning were way too aggressive, and just reliably missing them. And now they've, they still don't really know, I think, when this is all going to be finished, and they again set other deadlines. Instead of sort of setting longer term deadlines, under promising and over delivering, they sort of do the opposite, and they've gotten themselves into this rut where they can't seem to get out of that. So I'm not very confident on third quarter. That's the end of September of 11. it may, if nothing else, be sort of a ceremonial first delivery to ANA. We'll have to see.
Now, this is costing Boeing a lot of money. You mentioned in the article, Peter, that Boeing's paid more than $5 billion in penalties and delay concessions. That's a huge hit.
Yeah, I mean, that's obviously an estimate, and Boeing will never confirm or deny that. But they're not, let's put it this way, they're not denying that. So it's at least $5 billion, you know, that's not counting the cost overruns and all, whatever they're ended up, you know, the program being over budget, which is also significant in the many billions of dollars. So yeah, I mean, there's a huge financial aspect here. Beyond that, the sort of company's credibility in the marketplace with shareholders and with customers, you know, in previous months, Airbus has benefited from an uptick in some orders when customers couldn't wait for the 787. So, you know, Airbus has benefited by a few A330 orders that they wouldn't have otherwise gotten. You know, and airlines are fuming that they're stuck with their older equipment and they've been unable to start up new routes and all sorts of things that the 787 promises to allow them to do.
Now, John Ostrower over at Flight Blogger makes a couple of points about the questions that are still kind of open. But one of the things he raised, and we touched on this last week, was whether or not the first aircraft will come with the 180-minute ETOPS certification. I'm going to slip in a little bit of listener mail because it's sort of relevant to that. We got a message from Ian on our conversation about ETOPS, which we kind of glossed over last time. And Ian wrote in and said, no ETOPS does not mean no flight over water. ETOPS simply designates how far away from an alternative airport you will be allowed to stray. Literally, every plane has an automatic 60-minute allowance. And then Ian says, even with no ETOPS, ANA should have no trouble reaching most of Asian destinations, for example, Seoul, China, and Singapore. So I don't know, Peter, if you've heard anything about this notion that the first Sure. deliveries may come without ETOPS certification.
You know, I John Ostrower, obviously his sources are typically impeccable, so I'm not going to say, you know, I'm not going to dispute anything John is saying or finding. You know, a couple things. One, ANA, to the best of my knowledge, has not yet announced its initial route pairs or routings for its early 787s. There's some belief that their initial routes will be domestic, which would alleviate any sort of ETOPS concerns, obviously, if they're just flying in the home islands. But the other issue is, you know, I would be surprised, to be totally honest, if the first couple planes weren't ETOPS certified. I mean, it may not be 180 minutes, but it may be 120 or 90. I would be, you know, the FAA is obviously looking very closely at this program, even more closely than before, since one of their test pilots was actually pilot in command of Dreamliner number 2 that had the emergency in November. So they were actually flying the emergency plane, the plane that had the emergency. So they're obviously extremely, you know, closely watching this program and ETOPS included. And Boeing has obviously made some promises to its airlines that this plane will be ETOPS certified all the way out of the box, you know, right out of the box. So it may not be 180 minutes. I would be surprised if it didn't have some, you know, ETOPS certification beyond the 60 minutes. So that's sort of what I think.
All right. Well, it'll be interesting to see.
You know, and one other thing real quick. I mean, the other thing that people assume sometimes to get lost in the shuffle, especially when everyone is so focused on the first delivery of the Dreamliner, which, you know, will likely happen this year at some point, and it may even only be a couple, two or three airplanes that actually get delivered. But the bigger issue that Boeing faces is beyond the delivery is production ramp up. So looking in 2012, 2013, really trying to get, you know, 10 planes a month, 13 planes a month out the door. That's going to be the real challenge. And the customers, even if the first plane gets delivered, you know, by the third quarter or end of the third quarter or by the end of this year, you know, the real issue is customers are still going to be frustrated, I think, for the next couple of years trying to get their planes.
Yeah, that's going to be a big issue, certainly. Okay, next story comes from Aviation Week, Virgin America first firm A320neo customer. So this past week, Virgin America signed up as the first A320 customer, first firm customer for the A320 with the new engine option. Last week we talked about Indigo and their MOU, their Memorandum of Understanding. So they haven't signed up for a firm order, but Virgin America has. And this is for 60 firm aircraft, split evenly 30-30 between A320s and NEOs. So it looks like Airbus is kind of off to a pretty good start this year with the A320neo.
But yeah, this was a really interesting move announced on Monday. So it builds on the memorandum of understanding between Virgin America and Airbus, that was announced at Farnborough, and that involved 60 aircraft, just like this order, but it would be 40. It would have been 40 A320s with Sharklets delivered from 2013 to 2016, and then 20 options for 20 more in 2017 and 2018. That's changed a little bit. It's still 60 aircraft, but it's 30 A320s with Sharklets from 2013 to 2016. And then the other 30 will be A320neos with deliveries starting in 2016. So that'll be interesting. Virgin America still has yet to make a choice on the engine for both parts of the order. So so for the Sharklets aircraft, I believe you have the what's existing on the A320 series, so the CFM56 or the IAE V2500. And for the Neo, you'll have the CFM LeapX or the Pratt & Whitney geared turbofan. Their CEO told me and a few others in interviews this week that the goal is over the next few months to have a decision on both. So it'll be interesting to see how this goes, because this could be pretty good for CFM if they get CFM56 and LeapX for this order. Right now, Virgin America does have CFM on their aircraft. The big thing about the A320neo, reduced fuel burn, so that's going to mean reduced operating costs because of the less fuel burn. But Virgin has also been pushing this from a sustainability perspective, in the sense that less fuel burn, so lower CO2 emissions, lower nitrous oxide emissions. So that's interesting as well. But the other thing it does that the Neo has is it has about an additional 500 nautical miles in range. So that could, obviously could open up some new possibilities for Virgin America. And I actually was able to ask their CEO about that.
Yeah, there are a couple of things that the extra 500 miles in range gives us. The first thing, and probably the most pressing, is it allows us to fly our longest haul routes during the winter, during the heavy headwinds, without a payload restriction. So if you look at our Boston to San Francisco as an example, that's our longest stage length route. It is flying directly into the jet stream in the winter, and it's about a 6-hour and 40-minute flight, can be, during the winter. What we end up having to do is to fly that with an A319 or an A320 with payload restrictions. What this will allow us to do is to fly a full payload on those routes. So that's probably the most critical thing, is it allows us to operate our current network more efficiently. That being said, we are interested in serving Hawaii. That the Sharklets alone probably give us the ability to serve Hawaii beginning in 2013, but perhaps with some limitations. The key thing is that Neo in 2016 gives us full payload capability in both directions from Hawaii, and in particular from Maui, where you have a short runway and some runway obstructions that require additional performance. So the Neo certainly puts Hawaii on the map for us, and maybe we'll start a little bit earlier with the Sharklets.
That's Virgin America CEO David Cush, and I actually directly asked him about Hawaii, so I was just it was interesting that's on their that could be in their future. So, it's interesting. I mean, I'm going to guess, provided everything is on time with the Neo, this will give Virgin America a nice little cost advantage. I mean, right now, no other American carriers are going to have anything similar at this point except Frontier with the C-Series. But as it stands right now, Virgin and Frontier, there's really no overlap. So it'll be interesting if any other American carriers have something like the C-Series early, though with Virgin America being the launch customer, they will have the Neos pretty early, obviously.
Okay, military airplane geek question.
Yeah.
Have either one of these engines flown with this airframe?
No, and actually the geared turbofan will actually fly first with the C-Series, I believe. Peter, am I right with that?
Yes.
I think that's right. But the other thing is the C-Series GTF is lower thrust rating than the A320 GTF.
Yeah, and I think it's a slightly different. I think the diameter is a little different on each version too.
Yes, that's correct.
A320's got 12,000 more pounds of thrust.
Right. Yeah.
Than the C-Series will have. So neither of them have flown.
What's flown, David, on the GTF is that Pratt has flown a demonstrator engine that uses essentially a PW6000 core, but with the fan and the gear on the front of it. that's flown on test aircraft on a test 747, and also Airbus flew that on an A340. But that's all that's happened so far.
So we're talking 2013, and these engines haven't flown on this airframe.
Yeah,
has Airbus not learned? Have we not gone through A380 problems?
Well, actually, the new engines will not be on the Neo will not be flying until 2016. So this will not be on Airbus airframe for a few more years. The GTF will fly first in the C series in 2013, and I believe.
Sorry to be cynical, guys, but.
Yeah, well, I believe like the GTF is also further along than the Leap X right now. Is that correct, guys?
That's correct. Yes. Yeah, that's true. You also have to put some faith in, you know, you have to believe Bombardier when they say they're going to first flight and delivery of the C series will be on
fair
time.
Fair point.
Sure.
Never take a brand new airframe and attach a new engine and try to sell it to somebody. That's the biggest mistake you could possibly make.
Well, but that's sort of how this business works, David. I mean, the initial sales are made before the development is complete. It's not the kind of a situation. It's not like when you're buying a Ford, you know, and when you go to the Ford dealer to buy a Ford, they've already finished, you know, designing and building it. The initial orders come before the design is in some cases even started.
Well, I deal with the Pentagon on a regular basis. I understand, but I just don't understand how it's. Seems to me that Virgin America is banking on a sure thing that they're not even sure it's going to happen yet.
Well, I think the other thing that's I mean, it. The other thing is it depends what – we don't know what to follow specifically yet because Virgin has yet to make an engine selection. But the other thing for the 320neo is it's an existing airframe with strength, I believe. Yeah. I think Virgin said in their press release about 95% – common parts with the main airframe. I think the biggest change is around the wings because these engines are a little bit heavier. So that could be one thing in Airbus's favor. We'll say it is interesting, though.
Yeah.
Interesting as well.
Okay. All right, let's push on to our next item. This is from the NBAA, the National Business Aviation Association. They have a podcast called NBAA Flight Plan. And the January 17, 2011 episode is titled Advocacy at Addison. Now, we've talked about the poor track record of business aviation, you know, when it comes to getting their message out to the general public. We've mentioned that several times. And, you know, I think a lot of people, a lot of the general public believes that business aviation is all about fat cats jetting around in luxury. So in this episode of Flight Plan, we hear that one airport is doing something about communicating the value of business aviation at airports to the non-flying public. And as it turns out, our very own Rob Mark is kind of helping. Rob, this is about the Addison, Texas airport.
Correct. That's Addison's just outside of Dallas, just on the north end there. In fact, if anybody's been there, 4 square miles of town. And the Addison Airport takes up 1 square mile of that 4 square miles. So
wow.
It's not a huge place. But in all fairness, the disclaimer here, Addison Airport is one of Comavia's clients. So, I mean, the reason that I put this on was because I thought it was interesting, but also I have to admit, I mean, that, you know, we were involved with this, so I'm not trying to pull the wool over anyone's eyes.
Sure.
But what is interesting, I think, about this is that we started trying to do this. It's radio is really what it is. It's airport radio. And what we have found is it gives airports a new channel to be able to talk to the communities and not be completely, sorry, Peter, not be completely dependent upon the print media or the traditional media to filter the message. And believe me, I, as everybody knows, I well understand the journalist side. I mean, you only have so much space and you've got to grab a story when it's interesting to the editor and the writer. But of course that doesn't always work for the airports. And so we kind of promoted this. We also do the same thing up at Oshkosh. And we've got 2 other test airports going as well right now, which we should be able to announce here pretty soon. But anyway, it's a pretty cool way to talk about what's going on at an airport. And of course, as everybody that subscribes to the airplane geeks knows, I mean, once it's synchronized through iTunes, I mean, people can get it on a regular basis. And that's what really is one of the beauties of this whole thing. So we kind of – actually what we did is we stole the idea from the airplane geeks is what we did. But it was good. It was good stealing. I mean,
and you use the term social capital in this regard, right? Maybe you could explain that.
Social capital is a P. That's one of our big PR words over at Northwestern. We use that to impress the graduate students that we've charged them an inordinate amount of tuition for you know some good reason. But social capital is essentially building goodwill. Our company has never from the day one believed that airports have been much more than reactive. There are some that have been. Denver Centennial is a great one that's out there. And those guys aren't one of our clients, I'll tell you. But you know, they spend an awful lot of time out there trying to understand people that use the airport, the people that surround the airport, the legislators, the media, so that someday when there's a problem, it's not exactly as if a stranger comes up and says, gee, we have an issue here. Can we talk about this? I mean, you already have this relationship there somewhere. I don't know Peter. I've never met him before tonight. But after 6 months or a year of talking up and back about various and sundry stories, we learned you know what our capabilities are. We learn to trust each other in various situations. And then, so that when a story comes up that looks horribly negative, I can pick up the phone and call this reporter and say, "Listen, I just want you to hear the other side of the story." And the reporter is much more likely to listen to someone he knows than someone that calls out of the blue. And that's what that whole social capital thing is about. It's about you know kind of building that relationship that social media tends to do pretty well on.
And so this airport is doing that with Twitter and Facebook and their own podcast.
Precisely.
Right?
Yeah, precisely. And they're, it's new. We've been, it's going to be very, very busy down there in a couple of weeks for the Super Bowl. Of course, the game's over in Arlington, but every airport around the Dallas metro area is going to be just jammed with airplanes. I mean, they're not even sure they're going to have enough ramp space at Addison to hold all the airplanes they think they're going to get at the three FBOs. So, and then multiply that by probably a dozen other places to go in the greater metro area.
Peter, you must have hung around more than a few airports that serve the general aviation and business aviation communities. Does this sound like Rob's on the right track with this?
No, I am. I think, you know, it's definitely a good thing. And the more the better. It's sort of interesting. My home airport, the airport that I started flying from many years ago and still consider my home, is Santa Monica Airport here in Los Angeles. And it's about 15 minutes from where I currently live. And just, I think Friday, a federal appeals court decided it was not going to get involved in the latest attempt from the residents at that airport to ban the high-performance business jets, so the big jets like Citation 10s and Gulfstreams and the biggest, fastest jets. And residents have for years tried to get those planes banned from the airport because Santa Monica, like many of these smaller GA airports, is sort of smack in the middle of a residential area. And the courts basically said, no, we're not going to ban the jets and we're not going to get involved in banning them, so tough luck. So Santa Monica has just an atrociously bad relationship with its neighbors. I don't know if Rob, one of these airports you're talking about that may become a client is Santa Monica, but they definitely could use the help.
It's a very good point. I mean, I think that the relationships of some of the airports, Santa Monica or Burbank or any of those right in that area, are just so contentious that they're off the scale in one direction. Right. I don't know that some of the people in that community will listen to anyone, and that happens sometimes. But the key is to try to build the relationship before it turns into a crisis. And of course, sometimes you can't do that. It just doesn't work. But again, I think that some of these airports are finding that's a great direction as opposed to just sitting there, keeping their fingers crossed and hoping that what happens at Burbank or Santa Monica or Van Nuys doesn't happen to them.
Yeah.
And a good, and you know, to Rob's point earlier, you know, I think, you know, from the per, from the public perspective and from the media's perspective, you know, the best defense in this case is a good offense.
Right.
You know, and being reactive instead of proactive is bad. And Rob's absolutely right. Just, you know, not just in the aviation beat, but in any beat, if you develop a relationship with a reporter or a source does, and, you know, I will always take the call from someone I know, even if what they're pitching me is absolute nonsense, you know, over potentially
You didn't have to mention that. I called you. You told me you wouldn't mention that call.
Yeah, no, I picked up the phone. Okay. I picked up the phone and quickly hung up when Rob called.
Yeah,
no, but I mean, you know, if somebody who I've never heard of, even if they have a good idea, you know, my suspicions will be much higher than if somebody I know calls me up and we can have a sort of a more honest dialogue, you know. So I definitely think that aspect of it is extremely smart and you know, can do nothing but good.
Yeah, makes sense.
The only other thing I always find ironic and just it always sort of cracks me up is that, you know, especially some of these older airports that have been around for forever, you know, the ones in Southern California come to mind because, you know, Santa Monica is the original place where Douglas Aircraft was located and built DC-3s, and Burbank is where Lockheed was and turned out, you know, World War II planes and down in Long Beach. It always sort of cracks me up, though, that people move into these neighborhoods, you know, and are just completely, you know, the airport has been there for so long, and these people are, you know, oftentimes just outraged that there's airplanes and noise and you know, obviously they have an eye towards their property values and obviously towards safety. They don't want an airplane landing in their swimming pool.
Right.
But, you know, the volume and the sort of animosity that people have towards these airports, especially these legacy airfields, always just surprises me.
Mm.
You know, and largely it's because they've been there for so long, and it's like you know, you can't say to these people, well, you didn't know there was an airport in your backyard when you moved in.
Yeah.
I think it's almost just, you know, It's so frustrating when you see these residents who have been there a couple, 2-3 years complaining about something that they knew was there when they bought their house.
I know. It's odd the way that
logic,
you know,
works. To follow up on what Peter said, I think the thing that frustrates me the most is that when I work with these airports in various parts of the country, I don't get as, you know, they're always focused on the people that are yelling and screaming at them at town meetings and pointing fingers. And some of it can get pretty ugly, as Peter knows if he's down in the Santa Monica area. But I'm almost more worried. I'm more concerned about the people that don't do anything. I'm more worried about the people that just sit back and hope that someone else will fight the battle for their airport. And unfortunately, what often happens is that although these people that are yelling and screaming are often a minority, they're very vocal and they get to sound as though they're the majority opinion.
Interesting point.
That's where a lot of the work comes in.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, thank you for mentioning this. I'm really glad you guys got to listen to it at least.
Yeah, and we'll put a link in the show notes to the podcast so folks can listen to that themselves.
Yeah, and if anybody wants a you know, an 8x10 glossy of me, I autograph that too. And that would come at absolutely no charge.
Will that come with a Jetwine button?
Well, oh, listen, absolutely. Everybody gets a Jetwine button.
Eventually.
I have to get Peter's address so you get a Jetwine button too. Yes.
Excellent.
The Associated Press has an article out. China's new stealth fighter may use U.S. technology. I saw that and I thought, wow, what's that all about? Well, the last few weeks we've been talking about the Chinese stealth fighter, so-called stealth fighter, that's been first taxiing and now apparently flying a little bit. And there might be a relationship. According to this article, Balkan military officials and other experts have told the Associated Press that in all probability, the Chinese gleaned some of their technological know-how from an American F-117 Nighthawk that was shot down over Serbia in 1999. The Croatian military chief of staff during the Kosovo War says that intelligence reports said that Chinese agents were crisscrossing the region where the F-117 disintegrated, buying up parts of the plane from local farmers. Man. David, do you think collecting little bits and pieces of a crashed airplane is going to give you some idea of U.S. stealth technology?
Actually, this is the most sense I've heard out of the whole J-20 story from the beginning. Everyone wondered how suddenly China got a quantum leap into stealth technology, and here's the reason. Luckily, in a warped sort of way, they got old stealth technology. By the time in 1999, the F-117 was flying at that point it was old technology from the 70s, if you can imagine that. So the technology they used to glean from it for their new fighter would be way behind what we currently have. But it does explain the head start. I mean, it's no different than the Russians after World War II recreating B-29s and starting their whole bomber industry. So if you're going, the easiest way to learn new technology is get your hands on it and play with it. So this makes perfect sense.
Wow.
Now, one thing I'd like to add is it wasn't the technology that got it shot down over Serbia. It was poor planning on the U.S. Air Force. The Air Force was flying the same flight patterns every night during the campaign, and luckily, and on the same time frame. So an F-117 was crossing over the Serbian border at X time every night, and eventually put a missile up. at the right, and that's how it was shot down. It wasn't that it was detected.
Right,
it was radio frequencies.
Okay, thanks, David. Okay, again, our guest this episode is Peter Sanders. He's a staff reporter in the Los Angeles Bureau of the Wall Street Journal. Peter, I'm actually a Wall Street Journal subscriber, print edition, for quite a number of years. And one thing I've thought all along is that the aviation reporting in the journal is awfully good. And I guess maybe some of that has been your doing. How did you come to be an aviation writer for the Wall Street Journal?
You know, first, thank you. Thank you for the compliment. I definitely cannot take very much credit at all for that. I mean, a couple things before I even go into sort of how I got into the journal. But, you know, first is the team at the journal is very impressive, and it has been for many, many years. Now, I filled very big shoes. My predecessor was Lynn Lunsford, who worked for the paper for about a decade before he left a couple years ago.
He went to the FAA, didn't he?
He did go to the FAA. He is at the FAA in Texas now.
I know him.
A very capable spokesman and media policy maker for the FAA these days. So Lynn was great, you know, and before that was obviously Jeff Cole, who actually died while working as a reporter for the Journal in 2000. He was killed while reporting a story with the CEO, then CEO of Atlas Air, and they were flying in. Had the CEO's private Czechoslovakian fighter jet, David, that you may know the type. I don't remember what it was, but
it was an L-29, I think, wasn't it?
I believe it was an L-29, and Jeff was killed. Unfortunately, they both perished in a crash shortly after takeoff in Colorado. But Jeff was an amazing reporter and had the beat covering Boeing for many years, for at least a decade before he passed away. I have a great team with me at the Wall Street Journal, including the current crop of guys, Dan Michaels in Europe. He covers Airbus and all things European airlines, and he's really amazing and has been at the paper 10 years. So he really, you know, is a great part of the coverage. And then, of course, my esteemed colleague, Andy Pastor, who I sit next to, who's been at the paper about 30 years, and he is pretty much the biggest aviation safety expert that there is in the world, if not the country, in my opinion, for, as a news reporter goes. So the aviation coverage of the journal has been great for 20 plus years, and I'm glad to be a part of it.
And so how did you personally come to find yourself with the journal?
Well, the journal, I got very lucky with the journal. I went to, after a 7-year career as a paramedic through various states in the United States and fun cities, I went back to grad school for journalism and here in Southern California, and came out of grad school just sort of at the right time, right place, as happens with many jobs in people's lifetimes, and was able to get an internship with the journal right out of grad school, and then got... After that internship, sort of got hired straight in because the paper ended up having a vacancy in Los Angeles, and I needed a job. So I actually spent 2 years initially covering the hotel and casino industry, which was fun, and then did 2 years covering the Hollywood beat, which was not my cup of tea, but still fun. So after I had done my 4 years of other beats, Lynn Lunsford left the paper to go work for the FAA, and his job opened up, and I was able to slide into covering aviation.
You worked for a time, or maybe you volunteered with Angel Flight?
I did. When I was, I couldn't get enough aviation when I was in high school. I started flying when I was a sophomore in high school, and here in Santa Monica, at Santa Monica Airport, and ended up getting my private pilot's license right after I turned 17, and then volunteered in the office of Angel Flight. And the, you know, because I didn't have a lot of hours, I didn't have enough hours or own my own plane, which is also helpful if you work or volunteer with Angel Flight. I was basically sort of the office guy doing any sort of filing or any sort of office work that they needed. And then the sort of reward, even though it was a volunteer gig, was every so often when a pilot was going on an Angel Flight with a cancer patient or some sick person who needed air transport, I would get to tag along as co-pilot.
Yeah, that's pretty interesting. Angel Flight is actually one of the charities that I personally, you know, contribute to each year. It's I think it's a great cause. There really are quite an awful lot of pilots involved in Angel Flight, aren't there?
There are. You know, unfortunately, I'm not sort of up to speed on how things there are now. This was a number of years ago, but there are a surprising number of pilots who have every type of airplane from you know, Cessna 172s or 182s all the way up to, you know, Cessna 402s or Big Piper Twins. Occasionally you'll get guys that have King Airs or larger GA aircraft, and these guys are and women as well. These people are volunteering their time, their aircraft, they pay for fuel to get, you know, very sick people, often kids, from places where they don't have advanced medical treatment to big cities. And it's a really great organization and a great bunch of people who volunteer their time.
Just to jump back to writing, do you have any advice for people, younger people maybe, who are aspiring to be writers? Maybe not necessarily print media, but could be, right, or online, at least with an aviation,
sure,
you know, bent.
Well, I mean, you know, I think the most universal advice I could give, which people have given me over the years, is, you know, writing, if you want to write, you just have to sit and write and practice and practice and practice, because to become, you know, a good writer is it just takes time like anything. It's a skill. And, you know, once you have a skill in writing, then, you know, you will find that, you know, you're actually in relatively high demand, because there are, you know, many places these days, especially because print media and traditional media is being dwarfed by social media and other forms, blogs and all sorts of content. Yeah. They need people to write good content. When I was younger and sort of getting into the writing thing, I just sort of, especially in aviation, I spent a couple of years interning at Plane and Pilot magazine, which is based here in Los Angeles, and did almost no writing, unfortunately, but was, you know, surrounded myself with these writers and read the magazine religiously and saw how they worked. And, you know, you just have to, once you have a facility in writing, whether it's you know, however you want to do it, you just need to be aggressive and really go after it, and just try to get any opportunity you can. I think a blog, as your co-hosts would probably vouch for, blogs are a great way to practice that writing and to start getting a grassroots audience.
You know, one thing we've complained about on this podcast is that a lot of people who write blogs or who are otherwise involved in online content creation are often so driven by the motivation to be first to print with an item, with a news story or with information, that a lot of times the quality of the reporting is very low. I mean, do you agree with that? And how does a publication like the Wall Street Journal kind of try to respond to that situation?
It's a very good question. A couple good questions there. Number one, I do completely agree with what you're saying. I don't obviously think it's limited to aviation, but it does,
right, yeah,
you know, the inaccuracy does rear its ugly head in aviation a lot. One of my first jobs in journalism after graduate school, during graduate school, before the journal, I got worked for a local wire service here in Los Angeles called City News Service. And in a big poster or big sign on the wall of the newsroom, the quote was, "City News Service, get it first, but more importantly, get it right."
Yeah.
And that's sort of the mantra, you know, the journalism mantra. And it was one that I sort of grew up with. You know, the truth is, you know, the journal, we try to respond. I mean, we have incredibly high standards in terms of what we're allowed to print. And typically that means we need to have something verified from two independent sources,
mm-hmm,
whether or not they're identified. They can be anonymous oftentimes, preferably not anonymous. But, you know, we still have those standards. So unfortunately, you know, when I'm looking in the blogosphere and increasingly in the Twitterverse, as they call it,
right,
and seeing just these reports get blasted out, my hands are oftentimes they're tied. There are some extremely good aviation bloggers, many of them are actually on this podcast right now, and that you guys do a great job, and you hold yourselves typically to a higher standard. And obviously John Ostrower, you know, is another example of someone who,
sure,
really does, I think, a good job of reporting as it should be done. But it is a challenge for the traditional media to be able to chase this stuff. And In other ways, it's actually the bigger challenge is to restrain myself from jumping the gun. You know, when I see these things going down, like nothing will cause me greater chest pains and sweating than seeing, like, you know, these tweets start exploding or this blog post get picked up somewhere and, you know, run out. On the flip side, the lack of credibility in some of this reporting does a huge disservice to the people that are trying to do their best, you know, bloggers and other reporters, you know, and it makes it hard. And obviously it makes it hard for the sources, whether it's the companies or the airlines or whoever you're writing about. They start to get skittish and weird about sharing information. You know, Boeing has in the last few years done a very good job. I use good in quotes because they have basically started their own sort of internal news service, where they put out a lot of news and they hire a lot of ex-reporters and writers to basically produce Boeing-produced news stories that, you know, in the old days would have been sort of feature-type stories that the traditional media would have done. You know, so a big company like Boeing is sort of trying to take it into their own hands, and they're very active on Twitter to try to, like, make sure that good information is getting out there, or at least the information that Boeing wants to get out there. But it is challenging, you know, and there, unfortunately, I don't think there's a solution yet to the problem of separating reporting from facts, or, you know, people like to say reporting from journalism. You know, it's just really hard.
I just had one comment I wanted to mention. I mean, that, you know, we see this quite a bit in terms of, you know, the mainstream media and some bloggers, you know, kind of being at odds. And I think the people that the media is at odds with, at least in my perspective, are the ones that really don't care about the facts. I mean, there are times that, you know, when we put something out on JetOne, as much as I sometimes would love to say, oh, wow, we had that up there first, I am just paranoid about someone coming back saying, do you realize you completely got that wrong? I mean, that would just kill us. And you can only get away with that. I mean, you can't even get away with that very often in a newspaper. Right. But a blogger, for sure, can't continue in that realm, I don't think, very long. But although I do see, you know, we talked about this a couple of weeks ago, that some of the services like, you probably know SmartBrief, Peter, that grabs, you know, the headlines. And they're actually starting to use some of the bits from some of the blogs. But it was not an easy sell for those of us that were involved in that move, because we had to do an awful lot of promising and begging and you know, luckily no money turned hands, but right. You know, they were understandably squeamish about grabbing something. You know, they understand you guys, but they're not sure who that is on the other end of the wire. Some of us were journalists, but they don't know who you are and who you aren't.
Right. Well, and let me just say sort of one more thing on this, if I may. You know, Max, you asked earlier about sort of trying to keep up and be first. But the truth is, yeah. I mean, I'm a dyed-in-the-wool, diehard Av geek, and this is why I'm invited to join you guys this evening. You know, and I really do find all the stuff, you know, especially on the blogs and on Twitter, really interesting. But at the end of the day, a lot of what we see happening, and I've actually started to relax a little bit in the last few months, is that there's so much stuff that's so deep in the weeds, you know, and so detailed that gets blogged about or gets put onto Twitter, you know, whether it's a livery change on a certain airline or whether, you know, there was smoke in the cabin of some plane in southern Poland, you know, that a general newspaper audience in my audience that I write for doesn't care about or doesn't understand or would, you know, doesn't want to see. So the other issue that I see happening here is that, you know, the social media and the rise of sort of anyone can be a reporter, writer / you know, information provider,
right,
is that so much noise is out there. The clutter has increased exponentially to the point where it's almost not relevant at all.
Huh.
You know, and trying to find, you know, the hard part is trying to sort through all that noise and find a signal and say, okay, well, this blogger is actually onto something, or this tweeter has it right, you know, or the thing that this airline is blogging about actually matters. So in some ways, it's made my job just, you know, a lot easier, because so much of it can be ignored on a professional level.
Yeah.
On a personal level, I love all of it.
Yeah.
You know, I'll read about it till the days, you know, the end of the days. But on a professional level, my editors at the Wall Street Journal, and more important, my readers at the Wall Street Journal, their tolerance for this stuff is, you know, is relatively low. So,
yeah,
you know, they
sense.
Won't read about it in easily digestible form that, you know, they don't, they want to, you know, we have to pretend they know nothing about airplanes.
Right. Yeah. So there's a million little niches out there that other people can do have interest in, but yeah, but not mainstream. Okay, Peter, there's a little thing we do with our guests, our first time guests. We call it word association. And this is just simply, we will each say a word or maybe a little phrase, and then you just start talking about the first thing that pops into your head.
All right.
How's that?
Sounds good.
Okay. Do we have any volunteers to start off?
Oh, I'll start off.
Okay. Rob, go ahead.
It's two words. You guys probably knew that.
Yeah.
I can't ever do one word.
Rob has never done one word, I don't think.
Excellent. John Ostrower.
John Ostrower.
No, that's no, that's word. Not fair.
Is that
no,
the word association?
Who is that guy? I don't know who he is.
Who? John who?
No, how about favorite airline?
Favorite airline. Well, I have to give disclaimers on all this because I'm speaking personally, not as a Wall Street Journal reporter.
Sure.
Because I don't want to get in any trouble. My favorite airline right now, my favorite airline is Virgin America, sort of hands down, just in airlines that I fly typically. I think they're doing a great job, sort of all the way up and down, from the new airplanes, their service, the whole thing. I mean, they're obviously, I wish they were flying to more places, but Virgin America definitely. Internationally, Asiana actually tops my list. I've had the privilege to fly with those guys a lot. I make it over to Japan fairly frequently because one of my brothers lives there, so I go to see him. And Asiana is great. So those are my two international and domestic airlines.
I have to agree with you on Virgin America, but my issue is I'm on the East Coast, so I can only fly them to San Francisco and LA from Boston, which isn't even my home airport.
Yeah, that's unfortunate. I mean, my benefit is because of Boeing, they have LA to Seattle, so I get to take them to Seattle fairly frequently, and when I have to go see my bosses in New York, I get to see them. I can take them to New York. So yes, Virgin America from LA is a great thing.
Yeah, I mean, there's this banner ad that they've been putting out that I've been seeing for a while that it says what paradigms may have shifted during flight, and I think it's like it's really accurate.
Good. You know, absolutely. You know, they've done a really good job of figuring out, you know, just the things that people want on flights, the things that people don't want. And, you know, they do it in a lighthearted way, which makes things easier.
Okay, good. Dan, do you have a word for Peter?
You know what? Because you're at Wall Street Journal, my word association would be Financial Times.
They're very
We're not making
British.
It easy on this guy, are
they're,
we?
They're very British, and their paper is pinkish-orange.
Yeah, isn't that odd?
It is a little – I find it a little hard to read because my eyes just get tired of looking at the
colors. What I kind of like about Financial Times, though, is for their iPad app, they made sure to make it pinkish still.
That's – well, you know, it's their brand. That's their – you know, they got to stick with the brand, so they got something that works. But, no, they're – you know, they're a good competitor, and the truth is the journal – you know, our editors in these days, they have a very European flavor to them because we are being run by an Australian editor by way of London, and the number two guy is a hardcore ex-British reporter. So we, you know, look at them squarely, and they're competition, and they're good competition.
There's probably a good story behind the color. I don't know what it is, but that's also probably a topic for, I don't know, cellulose geeks or something like that.
Exactly.
David, do you have a word for Peter?
Sure, we'll go with Bombardier.
Excellent word. I actually just spent a couple hours on Friday with Mr. Pierre Beaudoin, of the CEO of Bombardier. He was in Los Angeles. I think, you know, Bombardier is in a tough spot right now. They obviously have a lot of competition coming from the A320neo. They are still on track, they say, with the C-Series for first flight in 2013 and entry into service, or first flight in 2012 and entry into service in 2013. They still say orders are coming at some point. But, you know, NEO is Mr. Leahy at Airbus has set out to crush the C-Series with the NEO. You know, Bombardier's argument is that the target market for the C-Series is the 318, 319, and that, you know, not the 320. So they still think that they've got a shot there. And they also make... they make a lot of money making trains, which is good for them because they need money to develop the programs. But look, I don't think you can count Bombardier out. They make a good product, and you know, I think the C series is definitely by no means is it dead yet. It may be slightly endangered, but it's not dead.
All right, we live in interesting times, I think.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Peter, my word is ATC.
ATC. ATC for me equals love. I love ATC. When I was 13 years old, I bought my first AvGeek equipment that I ever bought at 13. I think it might have been the first thing I ever bought over a catalog was a airplane scanner from Sporty's.
Oh, wow.
Pilot shop.
Yeah.
And, I started listening to ATC scanners when I was 13, and I still am a loyal United Airlines customer because of Channel 9. If they get rid of that, they will lose a significant amount of my business.
I always loved that. Absolutely.
It's great. And I don't think, the new management of United may not care, but I definitely will stop flying them as much if they take Channel 9. You know, I think it's an amazing job that those guys and women do. If you just sort of think about the sort of choreographing that stuff in the sky, it's a pretty amazing thing. And it's a language all its own. You know, it's basically a foreign language, which is pretty cool. I've also written at the Journal. I wrote a big story about the guys who do VATSIM, which is the simulated air traffic control, which is incredibly niche, but pretty cool as well to think that, you know, these guys who are sitting at their computers are basically behaving as professional air traffic controllers and guiding imaginary planes and imaginary skies. And it's sort of a mind warp. I'm interested to see what happens with the ATC going forward with next gen and with all the RNP and various different things. I think it's a total quagmire and it's going to take forever to get solved, mostly because the federal government's involved and, the airlines are involved. But ATC is great. And I have nothing but respect for the people who work in that field.
Okay, great. Well, Peter, we'd like to thank you for coming on the show. It's been a pleasure having you. Tell our listeners where they can find you online. You're on Twitter, sure. I believe.
I am on Twitter. Obviously, the first place to find me here and there is WSJ.com, which you can just search. If you want to read my stories, you can just search for my name, my last name in the search box. But you can also find me on Twitter. My official Twitter is at Peter Sanders, WSJ. And I'd love to see you guys following me and see anyone out there to follow. You know, the more followers, the better. And I not only link to WSJ stories and other stories of interest throughout the aviation world, but my witticisms and my shining personality come through on my Twitter feed as well. So those are the two best places to find me. And unfortunately, WSJ, we don't have an aviation blog yet, but one of these days we may get there.
Well, what about the middle seat terminal? Does that count?
That does count, actually, but it's just Scott McCartney's own gig. It's just his thing, and he does a great job with it, and he writes our middle seat column every week. So, but it's sort of his domain. So unfortunately, the three other aviation reporters, we don't really play in that space. But maybe one day we will.
All right, Peter, thank you again.
Thank you guys very much for having me. I really appreciate it.
The didgeridoo means it's time for the Australia News Desk. Here's two of the craziest guys we could find south of the equator. It's Steve Vischer and Grant McHaren from the Plain Crazy Down Under podcast.
Dateline, January 23rd, 2011.
Well, good day, folks, and welcome back to the Australia Desk for episode 132 of the Airplane Geek Show. And, Grant, we've had a bit of news this week, and I think perhaps you may know about it firsthand, but we'll get to that a little bit later. No pressure. Now, let's have a quick talk here about Air New Zealand and Virgin Blue climbing into bed a little closer by the looks.
Yeah, that's correct. It's the big news of the moment, and what's happening is that Air New Zealand is buying up to 15%, or it's actually 14.9%, but we're not quibbling, of Virgin Blue, which is about as much as they can handle where they're at. But once they cleared 5% of ownership, they had to tell everyone about it. They're saying that they're not taking over Virgin Blue. They're just buying into it. This is going to give them a better position to go up against Qantas in various areas. As some people have pointed out, isn't this exactly what Air New Zealand said when they were buying into Ansett just before Ansett did the big belly up back in the 2000s?
That's exactly the point I was going to make. I would imagine there would be quite some nervousness, although it is different times and, you know, there's far different structures in place these days, I would guess. Air New Zealand spending up to $135 million to buy this stake in Virgin Blue, and I would imagine there'll be quite a lot of nervousness around about the prospect of them buying into what amounts once again, as it was with Ansett, to a much larger carrier than they are.
Yeah, it's going to be a very interesting assessment of where it goes. I know our friend Ben Sandilands has been quite busy with his plane tour. talking blog, catching up on what's going on and monitoring it and attending the press conferences and so on. So that's going to unfold some more this week. I think we'll see some more analysis on that one as it gets a bit more into it. Yeah, it does sort of clarify a few things. Pacific Blue is no longer flying around New Zealand domestically. Then it's just out in the Pacific area. And I think we said way back when PacBlue pulled out of New Zealand that this was probably indicating that Virgin Blue and Air New Zealand were going to be working a lot closer. And then they started wanting to do their deals across the Tasman and code share and make things tighter there. So I think this could be just one more step in that whole Air New Zealand Virgin Blue partnership agreement.
Yeah, there's been a lot of changes to ownership over the years of the Virgin Blue company since it's been here. Toll Holdings, a rather large road and rail transport company, did at one point have quite a large stake in them. Richard Branson's Virgin Group still holds 26% of that company. So, yep. Yeah, interesting times. And boy, there's been a lot of changes around. You know, I guess Qantas would be happy that all this is going on because it's certainly taking the spotlight off them in many ways.
Yeah, although it's slightly shining on them because Air New Zealand are sort of indicating that they're going to be able to go up against Qantas better now with their structure. So, yeah, interesting times, mate.
Interesting times indeed. Now, let's move on quickly to the Royal Australian Air Force. And recently we're up at Amberley, Grant, talking to 82 Wing, which of course is a combat wing, but 84 Wing is the VIP fleet for the Royal Australian Air Force. A couple of 700 series 737s, the BBJ spec, and three Challenger 604s. Well, there's been some interesting information released under Freedom of Information recently, and it looks like they've been having some interesting mechanical problems with those aircraft, and that's caused a few diversions here or there with our Prime Minister, or as he was then.
It has raised a couple of eyebrows, and it's interesting that everyone's been keeping this pretty quiet. Not sure exactly what the causes of those mechanical issues have been. But what I find most interesting is that the newspapers haven't really made a big deal about it. Here in Australia, if anything happens that is related to an aircraft, and especially if it can be traced back in any way, shape or form to Qantas, they make a big deal of it since the A380 incident. And here we are with a Boeing BBJ that is owned by Qantas Defence Services and leased to the RAF and is maintained by Qantas. And yet the newspapers aren't making a huge deal out of it. I don't know if I should be happy about this, that maybe the newspapers waking up or worried that there's something else that's distracting them and that they'll come back to it later.
This is an article that made its way through all the News Limited papers by Steve Lewis. It actually is not that heavy on detail, which makes me think that perhaps it's a storm in a teacup kind of thing. There was one incident here where a trip from Perth to Brisbane had to be cancelled with former Prime Minister Kevin Rudd on board, and that was I think earlier last year because the plane had an oil leak. I'm thinking once again it's probably a number of these regular maintenance issues that are popping up that would happen with any aircraft, and let's face it, Kevin Rudd, who was a huge opponent of buying these aircraft in the first place, but then again has done more miles on them than anybody else, it's any wonder they're getting some maintenance issues.
Yeah, no, it's natural stuff. There's nothing too untoward about it. It's not something that doesn't happen to any aircraft, any airline or anywhere. I'm just surprised that the newspapers aren't doing their usual, "Oh, it's Qantas," kind of thing that they do.
Okay, well, moving on, Grant. Now, we've had a rather interesting week this week news-wise and aviation news-wise, and there's been an incident that happened here in our very own city of Melbourne, not involving any sort of helicopter or fixed-wing aircraft, but in fact, it's a hot air balloon.
Yeah, that's right, mate, and it was one of our balloons. I wasn't actually crewing this one. I first heard about everything as I was driving into work to go and man the office, and Essendon Tower called me up to ask if that was one of our balloons going out into the bay. And what happened was the guys were on approach into Albert Park. The winds shifted, and one of our balloons landed on a nice big chunk of beach. No problem. It happens at least once a year that a balloon will land on a beach here around the bay. But our other balloon, unfortunately, was being blown straight towards the narrowest part of the beach. He put it down, thumped it onto the beach, and slid into the water. And just when it was looking like, okay, we can drag him back towards the beach with a few ropes, the winds picked up, blew him out over the bay, towards the bay. So he put it back into the air and flew low over the water. We put our standard plan. We've got a standard response to an incident such as this, a balloon going into the bay, which is that we called the water police. They did exactly what they said they'd do, and all our planning came through. And he flew across to Williamstown. What wound up happening was that to reduce one of the variables, we transferred the passengers onto a police boat. So they went onto the little Zodiac rubber duckies onto the police boat. And then because the winds were pretty fickle and very light, they hooked a rope onto the balloon and towed the balloon with the pilot and a couple of police on to be ballast back over to the other side of the bay. And all systems went really well. The passengers were pretty happy, and it was great to see that our response plan worked really well.
Yeah, that's good, and it did make quite a bit of talk in the media. Here's how it came across on Melbourne Radio 3AW.
10 people have been rescued uninjured after a hot air balloon touched down in Port Phillip Bay this morning.
We actually landed on the beach at South Melbourne, and then because of the narrowness of the beach, the breeze got a bit stronger or something, and it just dragged us into the water, and then, just kept taking us out into the bay. So, it got a bit dicey there at one stage because we thought we might have, tilted over the basket with a... because our basket was filling with water. And then the balloonist guy managed to lift us off the water again, but we kept drifting out into the bay. Probably about 400 metres offshore before we saw our first police boat. And the balloonist guy here managed to throw a line to the police boat, and we offloaded it from the basket into the police launch. And now the... As I'm looking now, the balloon's actually drifting back out into the bay because there's a couple of police in the basket with the balloonist, and there's about three launches out of the balloon now, and I think they're trying to somehow tow the balloon back to shore, but it looks like the breeze is now taking it back out into the bay.
The balloon was finally pulled ashore at Williamstown just after 9 a.m.
Well, hey, Steve, it was an interesting incident, but hey, at least nothing broke, not like the KC-30 losing a boom. Oops.
Yeah, well, here we were just recently talking about how well our KC-30 tanker program's going, and now this happens somewhere over Spain. Now, this happened recently. It was doing some in-flight refueling tests with no Royal Australian Air Force personnel on board, we're told, and it was attempting to refuel an F-16.
That's right. It was attempting to refuel a Portuguese F-16 when part of the boom apparently snapped near the F-16's refueling receptacle. The boom apparently went up and hit the bottom of the KC-30, at which point it appears one of the guiding vanes broke off, and the boom started to oscillate madly before it ripped off at the base of the aircraft and fell into the ocean below. Both aircraft were able to recover safely. There was no injuries or anything like that. But yes, definitely some embarrassment on that part.
Yes. Oh, well, I guess it'll put the program back a few weeks while they repair that, and there'll be probably the all sorts of inquiries going on. So I'm sure that'll generate all sorts of news for us to talk about over the next few weeks. And yes, sorry, David, I can probably hear you groaning in the background, but we thought we'd better mention this story. Well, Grant, speaking of the beach and hot air balloons drifting off the beach, well, we're just about to run out the door and head down to the beach now since it's such lovely weather here. I see Dan sent us some rather horrifying pictures of lots of snow during the week. So, boy, I hope our friends across there in the US are surviving that cold. I think that would kill me. But we'll be thinking of that as we're splashing around the beach in our 100-degree Fahrenheit weather today. Until next week, I'm Steve Fisher.
And I'm Grant McCarran.
Cheers, folks.
Okay, this is the part where we lost the internet, and I found myself speaking with myself, which doesn't make for a great podcast, but we were able to recover to a certain extent. Here's Peter Johnson with his Across the Pond segment.
Here's my view from across the pond. Today I'm joined by the presenter and producer of The Flying Podcast, one of the best and one of the most successful aviation podcasts around. If you want to know about general aviation in the UK, then this is the podcast to visit. And it's why we're lucky enough to have Steve Cook with us today. Steve, welcome to Across the Pond.
Hi, Peter. How are you doing?
I'm very good, thanks. You?
Very well, thanks.
And Steve, can we just start by hearing a little bit about what your background in aviation is?
I came to aviation fairly late in life, probably about 10 years ago. I learnt to fly at my local airport, learnt on a Grob 115, which is what the RAF use for tuition over here. So that was probably about 10 years ago.
You've got your PPL now, yeah?
Yeah, did a PPLA. Not long after getting my ticket, I went over to Florida for a holiday. And that was probably some of the best flying I've ever done, and the most adventurous as well. That was superb. Flew down to Key West and up to a little island called Cedar Key.
Right, and how many hours do you have now in your logbook?
About 160.
What type do you fly now?
Yeah, I have a 1/10 share, a syndicate share, and a PA-28 based at a little grass strip in Manchester called Barton.
What do you think the state of GA is at the moment over here? Are enough people coming through the ranks for PPLs? Well,
one of the biggest downsides to aviation in the UK is the cost. Despite the cost, I think there'll always be a stream of new pilots from people that I've spoken to that run flying school. They've all said that the numbers are way down. I think over the last decade, the number of PPLs issued are down by about 30%. So, you know, where those people are going, I'm not quite sure. I think they may be going down to microlights, you know, which is like a cheaper way are getting into aviation over here.
Those people coming through the syllabus at the moment, are they all making it? I know there are lots of reasons for people dropping out. Do you see much of that in your experience?
I do, particularly here with the weather. I know, you know, you can go to the States and do your PPL in 3 weeks. You know, just people go to California or Florida where the weather is, you know, much more predictable than here. But when I was learning to fly, it took me over a year, and I was planning to fly once a week just due to, you know, technical issues, the weather, and being a grass strip, particularly during the winter, it's, you know, it's waterlogged very often. So you'd find you'd possibly be flying once every 3 weeks.
Yeah.
So that is a deterrent. And also, I think once people get into it and realize how much it is going to cost them, because people always say, oh, yeah, you can do it for 5,000. But I think as soon as you realize you're not going to get it done in the, you know, the minimum 45 hours, or you struggle doing your landings or whatever, and it's, you know, you're getting up to 20 hours before you go solo, people think, oh, it's, you know, it's going to cost me a fortune and drop out.
What do you think about things like some of the regulatory changes we've had over the past decade or so?
The NPPL, certainly for our American listeners, is a national private pilot's license that's issued just by the CAA. It's also been like a catch-all for people that had a PPL and then have lost it due to medical circumstances. So for a PPL over here, you need a Class 2 medical. But for the NPPL, you just need your own GP to sign you off. So a lot of people, I think, have been dropping down to the NPPL from the PPL.
Yeah, and you talked a little bit about flying in the States. Recently, some of your podcasts have covered some examples of that. Is that a trend that's continuing to grow, do you think?
I don't think it is, actually. I know people do aspire to go to the States just because of the weather, and it was, a couple of years ago, seen as being a lot cheaper. For example, I think 2 years ago, let's say when the US dollar was, you know, at 2 to the pound. Nowadays, at 1.5, it's less attractive. I think the Americans are making it a lot more difficult for us to get there, security-wise. You know, the people I've spoken to have said, if I knew then what I know now about having to go down to the consulate in London and queue up for hours and hours just to be asked the question, why do you want to go to America and learn to fly? Well, it's cheaper in the sunny weather. Okay.
Yeah.
You've got to go down there and spend a day, you know, yeah, just going through the hoops. When I listen to American podcasts about flying, I don't think they realize quite how attractive it is to the Brits and what a big potential earner it is for them. You know, I think they're shooting themselves in the foot by making it difficult for us to go over there and learn to fly.
When I flew over there, with freedom that I was given by the flying school was just amazing. They'd put me in a Cessna 150 and say, go fly for 2 hours. Certainly the controllers as well, I found, were extremely helpful.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, you can't fault them. For the sake of this podcast, I just had a look at how much it would cost you to learn to fly here. And just Avgas at my local airport now is getting on for £2 a litre, which I think if I do the maths correctly, for an Imperial gallon, that would be about $14. Heard the folks on the US podcasts complain about the price of Avgas when it was getting to, you know, $4.
And what do you think are the major challenges to GA in this country, and what do you think can be done about them?
Well, as I say, I think cost is a major one. Some of the folks I know have gone over to diesel engines, which a motor fuel here is a lot more popular than I think it is in the States. So you can run your aircraft on diesel, which is in effect Jet A1, half the cost.
Have you flown a diesel-powered aircraft?
I haven't. I interviewed a guy that flew one down to Israel very early on in the podcasts. He was going to go in our syndicate aircraft, but just the cost differential made it cheaper for him to rent an aircraft, a diesel aircraft. A lot of folks are going down the microlight route, which is a lot different over here to the States. Obviously, the new sports aviation type aircraft from Europe coming in, which run on MoGas, and a lot of them will virtually, you know, sip fuel at, you know, 15 litres an hour, which is incredible.
Well, Steve, thanks very much for your insight into UK aviation. For those of you who have not listened to the Flying Podcast, it's a great listen, and really enjoyed the last episode on Skywatch, the UK Civil Air Patrol. Steve, where can our listeners find you on the internet?
Website is at www.flyingpodcast.co.uk. That's Flying Podcast, all one word.
And on Twitter?
Yep, if you just go to Twitter and it's Flying Podcast, and also on Facebook.
Steve, thanks very much for joining us today.
It's been my great pleasure. Thanks very much, Peter.
You can find me at Mascot Hornet on Twitter and at alphatangopapa.blogspot.com. This is Peter Johnson, reporting for the Airplane Geeks from across the pond.
Okay, moving on to listener mail. First comes from Joshua. Joshua is 14 years old. He listens to our podcast on his 8-gigabyte iPad Nano. Joshua has two questions. One of them is for David, and one of them is for all of us. The first question for David, Joshua says he plans to be in the U.S. Air Force and become a pilot. I can't decide between a mobility pilot or a fighter pilot. May I please have advice on that? So, David, this sounds like it might be something that you could address. Any advice for an aspiring Air Force pilot?
Doesn't need to worry about making that decision. It'll be made for him.
You say that because you get in the Air Force and then they tell you what you're going to do?
Yeah.
Okay.
What happens is, and I actually have a cousin who's just gone through the process, depending upon your scores and your abilities, you get selected for pilot training. After basic pilot training, you get sent to whether you're going to fast jets or where you're going to transports or going to helicopters. So you may have your heart set on fast jets, but you might be moving trash, quote unquote, flying a C-17. But so keep an open mind what you want to fly. Just keep in mind that it's really you get to fly for the military.
Okay.
Number two, math. Math, math, math.
Really?
And when you're done, learning math, learn some more math. it's vitally important, and they want you to have it, and they would prefer you to have an engineering degree. So it's go to school, study as hard as you can, keep your grades up, try to get into one of the academies, or try to get into a reserve officer training program or ROTC. And then you're going to work really, really hard, study really, really hard, and hopefully you'll get one of those job trainings.
Okay, good. Good advice. Thanks, David. Joshua also asks us, what is the loudest aircraft we have ever heard in our life? The loudest aircraft. Rob, what was the loudest aircraft you've ever heard?
Oh, boy, that's a tough one. Has to obviously be some kind of a military fighter. I mean, but of course, the loud is really proportional to your distance from the edge of the runway when it goes by. But I'll tell you, I guess to me what I'm thinking is maybe an F-4 on takeoff when it went past our GCA shack in full afterburner. And I forgot how many pounds of thrust the F-4 put out, but two of those babies lit up are quite something to see when they pass 50 feet to the right side of where you're standing.
Dan, how about you? Can you think of a loud airplane you've heard?
Well, on the commercial side, there's just something special to listening to the DC-9. But I'm pretty sure, I think I remember properly, but Rob, I'm pretty sure there was an F-4 flying around at Oshkosh some point this year.
Oh, yeah, you're right.
And I'm pretty sure that I was going to go with the F-4, actually.
Yeah, and that wasn't even at full power. I mean, it was...
Wow. How about you, David?
I have heard the loudest aircraft in the U.S. military. However, my first choice, what I think is the loudest, would be a Harrier at full hover. There's nothing more noise-racking than that.
Good choice.
But officially, the loudest aircraft in the United States military is the Boeing F-18E/F Super Hornet. To the point where when they were originally starting to bring them in service, they were thinking about putting them in Brunswick, Maine, so they would have less issues with noise deprivation. But it is that is the noisiest aircraft in the inventory.
Wow. The thing that really first comes to my mind, and I think I mentioned this once a long, long time ago, was some years ago I was in a hotel basically at the end of the property off the other side of the fence from General Dynamics in Texas. And one morning I woke up to the sound of three F-16s screaming past the hotel coming in for, I guess, for a landing. But that was a pretty impressive way to wake up in the morning to the sound of F-16s. That was awfully loud.
Actually, you know, another one that was really loud actually was the Concorde on takeoff.
Oh, yeah. That sounded like a freight train.
Yeah, it really did.
And, Dan, you know why a DC-9 so loud?
Because of the JT-8Ds?
Well, yeah. They're A4. It sounds like a pair of A4 Skyhawks taking off in formation.
So thanks to Joshua for writing to us. Really appreciate that, Joshua. Keep listening. We also got a voicemail from Ian.
Good afternoon, Airplane Geeks. It's Ian Kershaw from Calgary Air Force. It's Wednesday at lunchtime. Well, it's 2:30 in the afternoon.
Can you guys stop talking about the weather? We just had minus 25 Celsius for a week. We're at minus 12 today, and it feels like summer. So can we go and talk about something else? Talking about the 747 Japan Airlines and their short-haul internal flights. 2001, I had the privilege of going to Japan. We flew into Narita and then took Japan Airlines to Sapporo. We missed the shuttle. There were about 50 of us. And within 20 minutes, they pulled another aircraft out. 777, high density, no business class. It just looked like a sea of headrests. And there were 50 of us in it. Alas, I didn't have the opportunity to get any photographs. So that's what you call high density. But that was a lot of seats. And following the thread on airbags in airliners, the one thing that crosses my mind is that if we had an incident and the airbags deployed and we had to get out quick, I'd be interested in comments on dealing with the variety of deflated bags on each row as we try to make our way out of the aircraft in a hurry. It could be interesting. Once again, great show, guys, and as always, good content, and I'm at 1 hour now, so I've got the next 30-odd minutes to listen to, and I'm sure it will be good too. All the best, and again, I hope to listen to you again in a week or so. Bye now.
Thank you for that.
Speaking of the weather, it's supposed to get down to like negative 22 Celsius. Yes, I did the conversion tonight, and it's going
to
be bad.
So what is it in Fahrenheit? We're supposed to get down to minus 4 Fahrenheit.
According to Weather Underground or WUnderground.com, cold with lows around 9 below.
Wow. All right. So sorry, Ian. We just can't seem to keep talking about the weather.
Although, and I'm running out of space in my driveway to put all this snow.
I know. I think it's piled up for you, forever. Max. Yeah. It's like 2 feet tall. Well, it's 2 feet deep, and the snow piles are a lot deeper.
They know how I felt like last year.
Yeah. So anything else on the weather? Oh, I have one more thing. I was talking to Steve Vischer today, and you know what temperature it is down there?
Mid-90s, I'm guessing.
68. Not bad.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah, that's very nice. Our next mail came from Alan in Ireland. He says, "Hello, geeks. I have a question that maybe you would like to discuss. With speculation that oil could hit $200 a barrel in the coming year, do you think there are any possible ways airlines could protect themselves against potential losses from the price of fuel? Is there a possibility for eco-awareness training for pilots and air traffic controllers? What about more energy-efficient airplanes or a different fuel source? Improvements in these areas could perhaps help airlines against the ever-increasing price of fuel."
Well, there are a few things. The first thing is that a lot of the changes that airlines will make can't be done very quickly. So, you know, Virgin America ordering A320neo, great reduction in fuel burn, but it's going to be a few years out from now. So airlines can renew their fleets and such, but it's reliant on how quickly the airframers and the engine manufacturers can get out new technology. But I think the airline industry overall has been doing a lot to improve fuel efficiency overall, because I think even after oil prices really decreased at the end of 2008, I really don't think anyone really thought oil prices are going to stay low for a long time. So a lot of airlines, at least in the domestic U.S. and across the world, have been doing a lot. A lot of airlines have been retrofitting aircraft with blended winglets, so especially the Boeing 737 is a big example for that. That saves some. In terms of eco-awareness, this is one benefit of RNP, is reduced fuel burn. So Southwest has made a lot of progress on deploying RNP. And the other thing, of course, is hedging, but that can be risky too. An airline can make a lot of money hedging, or you can lose a lot of money hedging. And there are a bunch of different strategies how to do that with different risks and rewards. So, and plus, that's complex. I mean, you're going to need someone to do the hedging. So it'll be interesting to see what's going on.
Well, but let's be serious. If oil hit $200 a barrel, the airline industry all over the globe, as we know it, would not exist.
I wouldn't say not exist, but there'd be a significant reduction.
Well, as we know it, and that would mean there might be just a few, but none of these airplanes were designed to operate and make any money on that kind of cost of fuel.
Yeah. That being said, I don't see oil ratcheting up an additional $100 in the next year.
The other thing I'd mention is biofuels, because we're seeing a lot of action in that arena. all the tests so far have been very encouraging, and it turns out that at least at a 50-50 mixture of biofuel and aviation fuel, there's no apparent negative effect on the engines. They can just cook along like they normally do. So,
though I guess the sort of like the new engine technology is how long will it take to?
Yeah.
I mean, obviously, great progress, but how long will it take for? Okay, well, how do we set up the infrastructure to get all these fuels to the airports?
Yeah. Yes. There's some questions to be answered on that. Okay. Next, let's see. Oh, Kevin posted this in the airplanegeeks.com comments. This was for Dan. He says, Dan, if a tree falls in the forest and nobody is around to hear it, does it make a sound? Similarly, if a terrorist doesn't try to take down an airplane and the TSA therefore doesn't stop him, have they done an effective job?
No, like I said last week, it can be hard sometimes to judge the TSA's performance in the sense that, okay, well, there hasn't been a terrorist attack since 9/11, but is that because of TSA? I'm sure there are a lot of listeners who would say no. I guess all I'm saying, I'm not saying I'm 100% pro body scanner. I'm guessing if what I'm saying is if TSA can deploy technologies and prove that there is a direct link between increased safety, as long as this improves safety without unnecessarily infringing on people's rights, I'm okay with it. And it's a delicate issue that will take years.
But they don't need to prove it. They just do it. I mean, they say, look, this is what we're going to do. They don't run out the research and say, listen, this is what we've checked out. We're certain this is going to work. Because for one thing, if you did have something, you don't want to tell the bad guys, right? But by the same token, you know, the infringement on our personal rights, we have no idea. We have absolutely no idea. And I don't think the TSA does either, to tell you the truth.
Hmm. Yeah, the thing I will say about TSA, I think this goes to some of the other emails we've gotten, is at least the TSA, we don't like them, could possibly make changes. I mean, the body scanners at the airports do not save images, for example. And I believe blogger Bob has written a little bit about how, maybe it was blogger Bob, maybe it was somewhere else, I don't know, but how these body scanners might not, for the screeners, show the image of your body, might show just like check this, like even show like a representation of a, not your body, but more like a drawing per se, and show like, okay, this is the area that's worthy of checking, but if you're okay, no one's going to see anything. So this will be a mess that'll take a long time to figure out.
We got a few other comments on the webpage from folks concerning our little discussion about security. Steve Fisher left one, and also Alex. Remember last time we had Alex and other Alex, the Alex from Australia and the Alex from China? Well, we got a comment from Alex. Alex says, I am the same Alex, Australia and China. Sorry you didn't realize that. What concerns me is that your government is not doing anything about the terrorist attacks at all. They are just hyping it up all the time and using you all. It's people like you and websites that should be pushing these incompetent bosses into doing something rather than going down these stupid draconian paths. Sorry to say this, but your bosses are worse than the terrorists. They are just killing the aviation industry. I sat on the fence once and watched the jets and the GA aircraft, but does Dan understand what that is like? And then there was another post from Alex, which was presumably the same Alex, and he who says, sorry, Dan, I ran out midway through, but seriously, Dan, do you really think things will change for your generation? My question is, why should we be going down the trail we are? We aren't going backwards at all because we didn't have this rubbish before. People, I think, have always regarded pilots as a safe and secure bet, and the TSA are trying their best to corrode that, which I take as very offensive. I am not a threat. I'm a pilot. That's from Alex, still freezing in China.
But you know, one thing I would say to Alex is that there are many of us that do agree with him, and I have certainly found that it is not easy to change the mind of anybody in the U.S. government. And also, having spoken with people from our congressional districts in the Chicagoland area, this is not a high priority for them. It's annoying to us because we follow this in the industry, but to a lot of them, it's just, you know, maybe it's bad, maybe it's good, but it's just not that big a deal to them.
I agree.
I mean, we could go on about this for very long.
Yeah, you're right. So we decided we weren't going to talk politics anymore, or at least not for a while. So, but thanks to Alex for, you know, drawing those points out. I think there's some valid points there, and I think this is good material for some serious thoughts and discussions. Finally, Philippe added some to our comments about airbags in airplanes, and he mentioned that the Cessna 172S NAV3 G1000 all come with lap belt airbags standard. Not exactly like the DA or Cirrus on the shoulder, but it's definitely standard airbags. There's another plane, Rob, that comes with airbags.
10-4.
Very good. Thanks to Philippe for adding to that conversation.
Hey, do we have time to just raise an issue that I'd love to hear Dan's comment on?
Probably not, but go ahead.
I'll be short. Oh, no, it's not bad, actually. It's really good.
Okay.
I don't know, Dan, I don't know if you saw that or any of you guys saw that note. I forgot where I read it the last couple of days about Richard Branson essentially saying maybe it's time to turn in the towel and link up with another carrier, either to get bought out or merge or something. And they were talking about Delta as a possibility. And Dan, have you followed that topic at all?
I have a little bit. It's interesting. I think Virgin is in a little bit of a tougher place than it was even 10 years ago as these transatlantic alliances have risen. And now especially that American and British Airways and Iberia have their joint venture has been approved and they're now operating within that joint venture. And London Heathrow is one of the big hubs, so that would negatively affect Virgin, who is a bit more independent. So, yeah, there have been some reports about Delta. The one that there was actually an article I was talking to Stephen Grant about this today that was very interesting is that possibly Etihad could be interested in tying up with Virgin Atlantic, which would be very interesting because Etihad has been tying up with Virgin, has been aligning with Virgin Blue. So it'll be very interesting to see how it all shakes out.
Thank you for listening to the Airplane Geeks podcast. Our guest this episode was Peter Sanders. He's a staff reporter in the Los Angeles Bureau of the Wall Street Journal. You can find his writings at WSJ.com. Just search for Sanders, S-A-N-D-E-R-S. And you can follow him on Twitter at Peter Sanders WSJ. We'd like to thank our foreign correspondents, Steve Fisher and Grant McCarron from the Plain Crazy Down Under podcast for their Australia Desk report, and Peter Johnson for his Across the Pond segment. Let's tell folks where they can find us online. First, David Vanderhoof.
Thanks, Max. I can be found on my two blogs, whatjustflewby.com and hhg2ma.blogspot.com, The Hitchhiker's Guide to Military Aviation, where we've been doing Desert Storm for the last week or so.
Ah, good. And Rob Mark, where can people find you?
Well, I was going to say something like you can find me on any one of our 11 blogs, but I guess that would be kind of silly because nobody would believe that. But yeah. On Twitter, you can find us at JetWine and at JetWine.com on the blogosphere as well.
Okay. And Dan Webb, where do people find you online?
You can find me, thingsinthesky.com, Twitter, Dan Webbage.
And I'm Max Flight. You can find me at the 30,000feet.com aviation directory or on Twitter at Max Flight. Be sure to see airplanegeeks.com for show notes, links, listener comments, and t-shirts. You can also follow us on Twitter and Facebook. If you'd like to send us email, we're at thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. We also have a listener line that you can call and leave us a recorded message. Benay Wilson will tell us what that number is.
And if you want to call the Airplane Geeks, you can dial 361-GEEKS-01.
Thank you, Benay. Opening and closing music is provided by Brother Love. Find him at www.brotherloverocks.com. Join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
See you later.
Thanks for listening.
Good night.
Oh, is this where I come in?
If you like.
Oh, okay. Give me one second, because I already lost.
Caller, can you identify yourself, please?
shut up. I'm really nervous right now. Okay.
Well, that's an outtake.
Dan, believe in yourself.
The recording light is on. Know that.
I know. Okay, here we go. Dateline, January 23rd, 2011.
Now you'll have to do that again because we had packet loss.
Oh my God.
Okay. Hey.
Okay. Dateline, January 23rd, 2011.
Hey, who was that, Grant?
I don't know. That wasn't me. I was just about to do it.
It's that crazy kid. Dan, are you hiding inside my Skype system somewhere?
Yeah.
Well, naff off. This is our show. You go back to your part. Yep. Come on, Chinese walls. Back you go. Back you go.
I'm sure the vast, growing, wealthy media empire of Southern Skies Media can afford, you know, three tickets to Australia in business class.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
I'm waiting.
So right. Who's staying back?
Ooh, wow. I'm gonna
go. Nicely said, David. I like it.
You know what? I'm gonna leave Rob back because Rob got to go to Dubai. So
yeah, yeah. But I didn't want to go to Dubai.